Welcome to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff McClure.
Together we are the two bald guys that are the Personal Wealth Coach. Today we're going to be talking about a question that we received from one of our listeners, Justin. What causes the stock market valuation of a stock to change? What is it? Why? What does it go up and down for? It's a really simple question. The answer hopefully is going to be simple too, but we're going to come at it from a lot of different directions because this is something we have found to be foggy in a lot of people's minds. We'll get into it. Don't worry, it's very conceptual. The idea of owning a tiny fraction of something is strange. So on the, after the bumper music, we're going to do the exciting announcements of our disclosures, and then we'll get to this question. Welcome back to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff
McClure. Together, we are the Personal Wealth Coach, which is an SEC-registered investment advisory firm, as well as the name of our podcast. Just because it's registered with the SEC doesn't give us any special expertise. Hopefully, our designations help with that rather than registration. Just because you register with the DMV doesn't really mean you know how to drive. Maybe means that you can drive a little bit under watchful eyes, but 80% of drivers believe they're above average. Think about that for a second. Just because we're registered with the SEC to give investment advice doesn't mean we can give it on the air. We can't give investment advice on a podcast unless we are certifiably sure that no one else is listening because there's privacy stuff. You have your disclosure to give as well?
Well, the information we present on this educational podcast has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable. However, we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of that information.
Fantastic. All right, so we're going to just jump right into this question. The simple questions are always the most fun from my perspective. When you're buying something in the stock market, what causes the price to go up and down? What happens to it when you give them? Who gets the money when you buy it? How does the price change? How do earnings affect it? I mean, those come out quarterly, and the stock prices change all through the quarter without regard to what the earnings are actually at this very moment or possibly will be. So we're going to start really simple. If you have one share for a corporation and they only ever issued one share of that corporation, let's call it Wally World. So you bought a share of Wally World and it's the only share of Wally World. You own the whole company. Well, that share price doesn't fluctuate very often because people aren't buying and selling it every day. You're the only owner. And it would only fluctuate when you sold it to whatever price you sold it at. If you think of the market as what the word actually means, mark it. That's really the meaning of the word market. They are marking the price of a sale. And a share price is, it's generally got multiple prices. You'll see an ask and a bid, a buy and a sell price. Ask and bid. A bid is what you are willing to pay. And an ask is what you're willing to take. So if you think of it from a perspective, I'm selling my car, and they say, oh, what are you asking for it? Or I'd like to bid on that. So bidding is buying, and asking is selling. So you see an ask and a bid price on a stock. Why is there a difference between the two? It's negotiation. It's a very split-second negotiation these days, but it is still some negotiation. It's also where some of the middlemen make money. You want to add something to that?
Well, that was the deal, and it still is in many ways. There's two prices on a stock, and the difference between the two is where the market maker makes a living. The people who operate the New York Stock Exchange and the other stock exchanges make a living on the spread between the two prices. They don't charge commissions.
Right. So there's a pretty recent thing on the market scene of commission-free trades, and yet you don't see places like E-Trade and Robinhood or TD going out of business. So how are they making any money if they're not charging to make a trade? Well, the answer to that is that they are selling those trades, the ability to make those trades, to somebody who can look around for a good price, buy it, and then sell it for a slight markup. That's the bid and the ask price. And sometimes that's more than the commission would have been on a trade of a certain number of pennies per share or something like that. Sometimes it's significantly more than that. Sometimes it's not. It's not very transparent. So rather than get into the nitty-gritty of that, when you own a share of a company, and assuming there's more than one share in that company, you own what's called an equal and undivided ownership by share. What does that mean? Undivided. It means that if you walked into Wally World with your shares in hand, you can't do that anymore because they don't make paper shares. But if you came in with your phone out, pointing at your brokerage account, saying, I own shares of this store, it doesn't mean you can go to the candy aisle and fill up your bucket and leave, because you don't own except a very small percentage of each of those candies spread out across everything in every store of Wally World, which is, as far as I know, is not a real company. It definitely has some nicknames around it. But so this concept, you own the company. Why can't you just take a candy? Well, because other people own that candy with you. And if you took it, then you're not equally paying those other people. You're saying this belongs to me. So what causes a stock price to go up and down? Well, in the old sense, going back to the people that trained Warren Buffett, Benjamin Graham. Benjamin Graham said that the stock price should be just the present value of all the future dividends paid. So what's a dividend? Well, that's an owner's share of the profit. If the company makes a profit and they decide, hey, I'm going to pay the owners, that's what a dividend is. That's why it's called a dividend. The same reason why you can't take the whole candy is because you only own a very small division of that candy. When you get a dividend, it's divvied out according to ownership. So in the old sense of what causes a stock price to go up and down, in the old sense, in the value sense, the old Benjamin Graham concept of what it is that they're talking about here, you would look ahead and say, I think this thing is profitable and it's going to pay me dividends into the future, and I'm going to guess this is what they're worth. And other people are making those same guesses. So it was a little easier to value a company if you were really strict and saying, if they don't pay a dividend, they're not worth anything.
Mm-hmm.
Except that Apple didn't pay a dividend for a very long time, and Microsoft didn't pay a dividend for a very long time. Tesla, Ford wasn't paying dividends when they started. So it was it worthless? What causes the price of that stuff to be worth anything? You want to jump in and add some of your viewpoint too? We can hand this back and forth.
Well, one of the things I noticed you said is they divvy up the dividend.
Yep.
Which I think is very appropriate, because div, the word div is the root of dividend.
Right.
So it literally is divvy, it's divvied.
It's where they're dividing. When I said equal and undivided, a dividend is where they step in and undivide. They divide it. They divvy it up.
The guy wrote in, Justin, was right. And basically, a stock or anything else is worth what somebody will pay for it. It's just, it's that simple, because the whole issue in people like us who like value stocks is that we look at the shares outstanding on the company and we look at the value of the company. Actually, we don't directly look at it. We look at the managers who look at it, although we look at it sometimes. And they say, wait a minute, the total shares outstanding for this company trading at this price could be bought theoretically. You couldn't actually, because once you started buying it, the price would go up. But theoretically, if you could sneak around and do it without anybody noticing, you could buy the whole company for less than its intrinsic value, less than the value if you went to actually sell the company on the open market, all its assets. It's worth something. We can figure out what it's worth on the open market. And then we look at the shares, and if the shares are worth less than the company, that's called a value company. And that's where a lot of investors go.
Right. So you mentioned something there when you say, I'm going to sneak around and buy up the assets. There are a lot of firms that just look for those patterns. They're called quant firms. And all they're looking for is, in the trading data, is there a lot of buying that's unexplained or a lot of selling that's unexplained? And they try to get ahead of it. They've got algorithms for it, but it's just as complicated as just looking around to see who's sneaking to buy it. Elon Musk got into a little bit of trouble with buying Twitter. Early on, he went to buy more than 10% of Twitter, and you're supposed to publish if you own more than 10% and are buying. And he didn't publish on the date that he passed the 10%. Why would you need to publish? Because at the point where you own 10% of the company, you become an insider. It's like you're an executive there. You have more access. You get to go to the boardroom and talk to people and figure out what the next plans are. So if you say, I'm going to trade and nobody knows why, that's insider trading. If you're an insider of a company, there's specific things that you have to file, forms that you have to file electronically that say, this is how much I'm going to buy on this date, and people can run ahead of you and buy it up. And they did. As soon as Elon Musk became public, he's buying Twitter. The stock price of Twitter skyrocketed because everybody says, hey, he's buying it. He needs to buy it. I'm going to buy first, and then he has to buy it at that higher price, whatever it is. It is supply and demand.
Which is evidence that it is purely supply and demand, because this company is worth something. The market looks at it and says, here's what a share should be worth collectively. And then somebody starts buying the shares. And the share price goes up. Why does the share price go up? Because somebody's buying it, so it must be worth more than I think it is. But it really boils down to, and that is one of the things that is very uncomfortable to think about. It isn't the earnings. It isn't the price-to-earnings ratio. It is just what collectively the people who are doing the buying and selling in the market believe a share is worth. That's the price it will go to.
And on average, that's a pretty correct number. It's kind of like, yeah, I don't know if you've read about these or seen the experiments where they have a big jar full of gumballs at a big county fair, and they say, mm-hmm. I want you to guess how many gumballs are in here. And everybody guesses, and almost nobody wins. It's just really rare to have somebody guess it on the dot. Occasionally, I mean, you always have to have a winner, so they say the one that's closest to it. But over time, they've done research into this, and what they've found is the average of all the guesses is very close. It's usually even closer than the winner to the actual number of gumballs in there.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this concept where a mob's IQ drops, but when an individual, a lot of individuals, make individual guesses as to the correct value, the average to that value is, for some reason, really close to accurate. Well, for some reason, in the market, accurate is just whatever the price is. So this is, like you said, it's disturbing to think about. But the reality is, it's no different than your house or your car. If you say, I want to sell my house and I have to sell it today, does that affect the value of your house? Yes, it does. That's a fire sale. You have to get the money now. If you had a longer period to look for buyers to come in and do it, your house value might be different. Does it change the value of your house? Yes, in dollar terms. If you don't sell, if you haven't done anything to your house at all, you're just living in it, has that changed the value of your house? Don't know. Nobody knows. You're not trying to sell it. We don't know what the value of your house is. You can hire an appraiser, but they're going to give you an estimate. They don't know the value of your house either. What does an appraiser do to figure out the value of your house? They look at your market, houses like yours in your neighborhood. Same square footage or close, same kind of quality, same size lot. And they say, these five over the last 2 years sold at this value. And so I'm going to assume the same square footage value for your house. In the stock market, it's very similar, only much, much faster. You don't have to look for similar houses. You just look for the same company stock. You're not the only owner. And other people are buying and selling that thing. So they look around. What was the last sale? It was at this price per share. Therefore, that's the marked price. The market price for that stock is set at that number. Is Twitter really worth what people have claimed it's worth? So if Elon Musk went to sell all of Twitter today, would he get his $40 billion back? No, he wouldn't. Not unless he had somebody already lined up to do it, because that's another fire sale thing. Is X worth $44 billion. Maybe. It's possible. It is certainly a large platform to give a lot of information out to the public. Some of it can be true and some of it can be false. When you put a price tag on something, it doesn't matter if you're at a farmer's market or a pig sale or the stock market. Just because you put the price on it doesn't mean somebody's going to buy it for that price. And you have a little bit less influence on that in the stock market. You can set what's called a limit order when you're selling a stock and say, I won't take less than this. It's very much like what happens at an auction when you say, I want to sell my grand piano, but I'm not going to take less than $5,000 for it. So if nobody bids on it, it just doesn't get sold. And if everybody bids on it, but they don't bid more than $5,000, it doesn't get sold. So the limit order on stock says, I know this thing is worth at least this much. Now, whether or not that's true is irrelevant. You know it. You won't take less for it than that number. All of this stuff is opinion and confidence and belief. If you owned all of a company and you got to keep all of its profits for yourself after paying all your employees and all of that, it's irrelevant what the price of the business is. It doesn't matter because you have a stream of profits coming in. If you want to sell it, that's when it starts becoming important. And if you think of that the same way you think of any other supply and demand situation where you come in and you say, hey, this is what I have. If you have good earnings in this company, that's obviously a positive where they're going to say, this is good. If you have no earnings in a company, that's usually a negative, but not always. I'm going to bring up a meme stock from 2020 and 2021, GameStop. GameStop hasn't been making a profit, so I'm going to start the story in 2020. It hasn't been making a profit for 6 or 7 years. No profits, only losses. Well, why? Well, because people aren't buying games at stores anymore. They're buying them by clicking or by pushing their controller button on their game console. They're not going out to a physical location and looking for a box with DVDs or something. Most people don't even have DVD players on their computers anymore. So why would you go to the store to buy that when you can go elsewhere? Well, GameStop was going downhill and it was really getting crushed. And a big hedge fund stepped in and said, I think this company is about to die. It's going to go away. So I am going to borrow a whole bunch of their shares from somebody else. And I have to pay that back to them. And once I borrowed it, I've got to pay it back. And I'm going to sell it all right now because I think the price is going to go down in the future. And they did. That's called shorting a stock. And when you don't own the stock that you're shorting, it's called a naked short. And just as bad as that sounds, that's how bad it could be if what happened to GameStop happens. And that is people recognized, hey, hedge fund just sold a bunch of it and they have to buy it back to pay back their loan. Because the loan's not in dollars, it's in shares. They have to return those shares. So they have to buy shares again. They don't have the shares to hand back. So if we all just jump in and buy it up, so that the share price is high, then they'll pay us whatever we want basically for it because they have to pay back that loan. That's called a short squeeze, and it's usually one hedge fund doing it to another. In this case, it was a bunch of people getting together online and saying, how can we lose? Well, a lot of people lost because they stayed in too long. A lot of people made a lot of money. A lot of hedge funds made money. And even the original hedge funds that got squeezed came back and did some squeezing of their own and wound up making money. The amateurs didn't do well. Because of that same foggy, what does this even mean? What's causing the price to go up? Even the people that got convinced, hey, we have to do this, it's a no-brainer because they have to buy the stock back. They didn't know when the stock was getting bought back. So they didn't know when to sell. They just thought somebody else was pushing the price up. And eventually the price came back down.
There's one other aspect of that. The guy who first started it he's a geek. And I understand he was doing some calculations and he concluded that because when you borrow a stock, it can literally be borrowed from you who borrowed it.
Yes.
So there had been more shares sold of GameStop than existed.
Correct.
And somebody's got to buy them back. So they literally were going to have about 115% somebody has got to buy 115% of the stocks of GameStop at that point, as I recall. And that's why he published that, and he bought some, and a bunch of people jumped on with him. And the bottom line to it is these guys are going to be they're talking about a squeeze. I mean, right down to the point where after the price goes up, you got to find a share to buy.
Right.
I mean, the issue is they got to buy a share to sell it, but there weren't enough shares to buy, which means they're going to have to multiple buys would have to occur for every share in order for people to pay off their loans, which is crazy. But that was the situation they were in, and then it became just nutso.
Yeah.
You know, like what is a Bitcoin worth? Nothing except that people pay for it, and it's sometimes called the greater fool theory. I may have paid a lot of money for something that has no value, but as long as there's a greater fool who'll pay more money for it, I'll make money.
Right. So GameStop in 2020 started out the year at less than $2 a share, and it jumped up to above $80 a share, and it's now down at $13 a share. So eventually, what's going to happen to this company is if it doesn't start making money, it's going to run out of money and go bankrupt. It won't be able to pay its employees. Is it possible for a company that has no money to have a high stock value? Yes. It's weird. It can happen. There are companies right now that are newly introduced that have no value, but people are buying it up. So any new startup, any new company that's coming up with this new way of preventing some kind of chin rotting virus, or a new company that's devised a way to push a button in your car and cause you to eject to the fourth floor of an office building, they're by definition not able to make a profit yet because there's no market for what they're doing. It's new. I'm not sure that I would buy the ejection seat thing. It seems like first early adopters might get smeared onto buildings, but the idea is, hey, somebody might buy this. So by definition, most startups fall in the category of no assets and no profits, only debts. And yet, if we don't pay for them, they never get profits. When Facebook opened up and did its first initial public offering. Its first initial. You see what I did there with the redundancy?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it did its initial public offering. They weren't making any money. Zero. They had no idea what they were going to do to make money. And we on our radio program talked about it and said, it's possible this is going to go great. I love Facebook. I'm using Facebook. But I'm never going to be the one buying at the initial public offering. Now, Facebook has done quite well. It's just, it is far more likely for these new companies to fail than to succeed. Far more likely. In 2021, we had an absolute record number of initial public offerings, and the vast majority of them have crashed and burned. Some of them have continued to do well. That's true almost in every way you think about business. Most new businesses don't make it. There are easier ways to approach starting a business. If you're starting a business based on like the way Michael Dell did it, for instance, Michael Dell's in his dorm room at UT, and one of his roommates says, hey, can you build me a computer since you're building a computer? Sure, give me some money and I'll buy the parts. He didn't go into debt. The guy's paying him in advance. He bought the computer. He kept some profit. He started hiring his roommates. Hey, everybody wants computers. They like the computers I'm making. I'm going to buy the parts after I receive the money. So some companies start without venture capital and without big debts, without huge influxes of millions of dollars from angel investors, which, by the way, angel investors generally have horns, not halos. They are the ones that come to the wedding with the divorce papers signed. They want their money out. So just heads up, if you're ever in a startup, venture capital, angel investors, that's a good way to destroy your company, but it's a fast way to get to market. So that's a different danger to talk about. The concept here of what causes the value of a company to be the value of the company, we call it market capitalization usually. So there's market cap and there's a book value. These are two values, and they sometimes are extraordinarily different from each other. So what's the right one? Yes, They're both right and they're both wrong. The book value is usually you take all of the assets and you subtract all of the liabilities, what you or I would call on our daily basis a net worth. Here's the problem with that. In your net worth, it makes total sense. Here's my house. Here's my mortgage. Subtract one from the other. What's the value of my house? It's relatively easy to guess. It may not be correct, but it's relatively easy. What about the value of the name GameStop? That's called goodwill value. The reputation of a company, the name of a company, its recognition amongst people adds to the value. And there's never really a good way of putting a value on that. One that could get us into hot water immediately, but it's a fantastic example. What is the value of the name Trump on a building? And for some people, it's extraordinarily high. And for some people, it's extraordinarily low. You can understand that both of those opinions are valid. The people with the low opinion of it are never going to buy it, ever. They would never buy any piece of it. The people with a high value might buy something from that just because of the name, not because they actually want anything involved there. They just want the name. So the name of a company adds to its value, and that's a supply and demand thing, but it's also something that can turn around and go the opposite direction from high to low or low to high. Just think of the brand Yeezy with Adidas or Adidas if you're in Europe. Yeezy with you know, you've got this great individual backing it. You've got name recognition everywhere. Well, now he's tweeting things that most people find despicable. Will people stop buying his shoes? Well, a lot of people did, but Adidas didn't want to sell them anymore. The idea of being associated with people that had those opinions looked bad on them. It was causing their share value to drop while the Yeezys were doing well. If you're making $1 billion on one product line and your company's worth $50 billion, but your whole company's value is dropping 10 or 15% based on what one of your financial partners is saying in a public setting, you probably want to stop that damage, because the damage to the company, even on the product line that's still profitable, it maintained its profitability all the way through bad words. Adidas was suffering. And they said, whoa, we got to stop. Your $1 billion for the next, 4 or 5 years does not compare with 10% of our market value. It doesn't compare with a big billionaire investor wanted to come in and invest with us, and they decided not to because we're associated with people that they find deplorable. So that's all part of the price of a company. There's no easy way to boil it down to one thing. Benjamin Graham saying dividends coming back, that means profitability. But that doesn't apply at all to a company that comes and changes the world, whatever way possible, and isn't paying a dividend.
A big way of valuing companies in the past, and it's still talked about a lot, is the price-to-earnings ratio. How's the price-to-earnings ratio of this company versus the other? In other words, how much are you paying for a year's earnings, the profits of that company when you buy a share? And it is treated like it's a science or something.
Right.
But the reality is, the science just is in psychology. My career, which is admittedly spans 4+ decades, but still, there was a 15 price earnings ratio. In other words, if the price of the stock, all the stock outstanding, was 15 times this year's earnings of the company, that was considered to be unreasonably high when I started. And that was markets would peak there and crash. Now, the average is about 20 or 22 times earnings. And it's one of the reasons the stock market goes up faster than the economy grows, is because the price to earnings ratio keeps going up. People are willing to pay more and more for earnings. Now, there's no reason they should pay for earnings or not pay for earnings, because the earnings mean nothing. They don't get any money from the company when it makes money.
Unless there's dividends attached to those earnings.
Yeah, and dividends is a different issue altogether. A lot of these earnings, the big earning company right now, don't pay dividends.
Correct.
In cases. So the issue is, people come up with mythological ways of valuing stocks, but the real value of a stock is what somebody else will pay for it.
And here's another example of something weird. Google comes to market. They did their IPO. They made a massive amount of money. Money flowed in. What happens to that money in an IPO? It pays the original investors. Some of that money goes into the company itself to build it up and make it better. And they set that up in the IPO. So when you're buying in the initial public offering, you're paying the initial founders and the initial shareholders. Some of them are selling to you. And you're also directly putting money into the coffers of that company. After the company's out there, when you buy a share of that company doesn't get any money unless they're releasing new treasury stock. That's what they call it when they have stock that they've already issued but that the company owns. They can sell that back. They can also buy it back from you. Apple's done that over the past 5 years. They have done about $100 million a month in share buybacks over the last 4 years, keeping their price point high, and yet their share ratio to earnings has gotten better because there's less outstanding stock. So there's a lot of different ways of approaching that. When you look at a share price, what do you get from it? What is it that you have? When Google did their IPO, they said, we've got two share classes. The owners have 10 votes per share, and everybody else has one vote per share. And that was fantastic. Everybody goes, I'll be part of that. The founders want to keep their majority. That makes sense. They want to keep control of the company. Totally on board with that. Okay, good. So they're going along for a few years, and they want to release another public offering. More shares, raise more money. They issued a third share class that had no voting rights. So owners get 10 votes per share, everybody else gets one vote per share, and then on this last share class, you don't even get to vote. So you're a silent partner with no say-so as to who's hired or fired on the board. And the board's the one that sets up who's the executive officers. All of the C-suite is hired by the board. The board gets voted in by the shareholders. And in this new share class, it was non-voting. The only other major event in history up to that point that had non-voting shares was in the early 21st century when the Justice Department was going after Microsoft for antitrust. They had a monopoly. Apple was failing. It was almost gone. It was drowning. Steve Jobs wasn't there. They weren't making anything innovative. It was not looking good for Apple at all. So the Justice Department starts squeezing in on Microsoft. And Bill Gates took $100 million of his own money. And he went, $100 million doesn't seem like a lot compared to the $40 billion that Elon Musk threw at Twitter. But he went over to Apple and he said, I will buy $100 million of your company, but I can't vote because if I vote, I'm just extending my monopoly. I'll be in control of both big computer makers. That's not going to work. So don't let me vote. Make a new share class and I will give you $100 million and I will own part of Apple, but I'll have zero control. This is weird. Why would you do that? Well, he did it because he wanted competition from Microsoft. He got it. He definitely got it. That's how they hired Steve Jobs back. They were able to afford him to get him back from Pixar, which he founded and started while not CEO at Apple. So you look at these little pieces of it. Ownership is purely in our brains. If you think about, you're living in a house and you own the house. How do you know you own the house? Well, there's a title registered at the county. Okay. How do you prove that to somebody when you come home and they're in your house and they say, no, we live here. This is our house. And they show you a piece of paper that shows that they bought it from somebody else. Well, now you have to do like forensic accounting to see where the titles were put. And is this a squatter and who's gotten scammed? And did I get scammed or did they get scammed? And ownership is a collective belief. We all agree that you own this because it's registered at a government office. But the old saying about possession being 9/10 of the law is true in a lot of cases. If you have a vehicle, and I've run into this a couple of times, not the vehicles. I have insurance, but I'm trying to avoid running into vehicles. If you own a vehicle, you bought it from a dealer, and you've got your financing all done, you've signed all the papers, it shows up, and then they call up and they say, hey, we can't find the title. Guess what? You don't own that vehicle. You paid for it. You paid for the vehicle, You got it from somebody, but you don't own the vehicle because they can't find the title. They can't transfer the title to you. If they can't transfer the title to you, then you don't own the vehicle. That is just the way it works. The title process in ownership of stock is done at the transfer agent. There is a transfer agent that sits at the company whose job it is to record all the owners of the company to make sure that their votes are accounted for, that if they get to a point where there's a contentious vote and there's not enough people to vote, they don't have a quorum, they have to contact their shareholders. So when you buy a share of a company, there are all kinds of Robert's Rules of Orders about voting. But if you have non-voting shares, what does it mean? And you would think, based on Benjamin Graham, not only does it not have dividends into the future, but you also can't vote for it. Why should it ever have any value? Because people have agreed that you own the company. And when you want to sell, they want to own that company and vice versa. Or they don't, and that can cause the stock price to go down. So we have collectively agreed that owning something as a silent, unvoting partner can be worthwhile because you're owning part of the company. Do you have anything to wrap this up?
No, other than it's sort of peculiar. Bonds are very different than stocks. That's another thing to point. Bonds are fairly simple to figure out what they're worth. Basically, if it's a AAA rated company and it's paying a certain interest rate and current going interest rates are a certain amount, you can actually do a mathematical computation, go to the market, and the bond will be priced right there.
Yeah,
stocks are very different.
Yeah.
Stocks are worth whatever somebody thinks they're worth. It is purely, and that's the funny thing, economists and stock market academics have tried really, really hard to create something that looks like physics by which the stock market operates. It doesn't. It operates by collective opinion, which is extremely fickle. And that's one of the things that makes it interesting. And that's why sometimes you can make a lot of money in the stock market is because you happen to get ahead of public opinion.
All right. So that's our wrap up on prices in the market. It's a strange one. If you would like to talk to us, not on the podcast, or if you want to send us a question that we can cover on the podcast, you can talk to us directly. We actually do give advice on how to manage portfolios and then actually manage the portfolio when we give the advice at a fiduciary level, no less. If you would like to talk to us, our phone number locally is
254-947-1111
or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can find a veritable morgue of newsletters, podcasts, and old radio programs going back into the depths of history. You can contact us on the contact form there or email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back with our next episode, whenever that might be.